Special Committee on Energy to order. It is 8:05. If I could have folks silence our cell phones. Members present today are Representative Foster, Representative Hughes, Representative Higgins, Co-Chair Isaacson, and Representative Nagyak. We do have a quorum to conduct business, although we're just having an overview this morning, and I anticipate Representative Josephson being here in just a few minutes. Today, the purpose of our meeting is to hear two presentations. One is the All Alaska Energy Solution from MiraCorps. I've heard this presentation before, but every time I hear it, I learn something new, so I'm excited for that. Solutions for a Sustainable Renewable Resource, today from Ward Sattler, President of Alaska Resource Agency, and Dr. James Houck. So with that, Amira, if you'd like to come forward and put your name on the record and start your presentation, I'm looking forward to it. And for those of you that don't know, Alaska Power Association is having their annual meeting right now. So all of the utilities are in town, and I apologize for not being able to be part of your panel yesterday. But I'm glad you had the Senate President to fill in for me. So with that, Mira, thank you very much for being here.
All right, I think I'm live here. Thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm going to try and pull this up into a slide show. Let's see, where is it? Oh, down here. Okay. My apologies. My name is Mira Kohler, and I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. We are an electric nonprofit utility that serves primarily Western Alaska. We have 55 villages that we serve, and we have been looking since our inception in 1968 for solutions for rural Alaska. And I'm very excited to talk to you today about something that I think truly is not just a solution for rural Alaska, but really addresses all of Alaska's energy needs. So with that, I do have online Dr. Rob Jacobson. He is the second individual who's named in this presentation. He was not able to be here in person, but he is available for questions and answers and conversation later on. He is a technical guru, so he does tend to get wrapped around the axles, so I'm going to keep him quiet until the time is appropriate. So with that, let me just say where the genesis of this project came from. I was tapped to co-chair, along with Ethan Schutt, a committee of Commonwealth North. I think you're all familiar with Commonwealth North. And we were looking at the challenges to a sustainable energy future for Alaska, and specifically targeting the rural issues. So the cardinal question that we ask is, why, in the midst of plenty — we are an energy state — do Alaska's rural communities pay the highest prices in the nation? And it's not just Alaska's rural communities anymore. Fairbanks is going through exactly the same thing that we have been suffering from in rural Alaska for many, many decades. So the disease is spreading. This is a quick graphic of AVEX fuel cost in the last 10 years. And what you can see is that in 2002, the average cost of a gallon of delivered oil was $1.29. And last year, our average cost for a gallon of delivered fuel was $4.03. That is a very substantial increase, over 300%. And it's reflected not just in the electric bill, but primarily in the fuel bill. That is the real challenge in Alaska, is the cost of heating your home. So our group wound up with six findings, and I very briefly touched those findings. The first finding is that Alaska needs a statewide energy vision, a plan, and a pathway to completion. We started with that in 2010 when we adopted a House and Companion Senate bill that essentially established a vision for Alaska, but there never was a clear pathway established. I don't think we could come to agreement on that, but there is a way to get there. And we need to take a look at that. The second finding is that we need to develop grids across our state, because when you have an electrical grid, you're able to enjoy economies of scale, efficiencies of generation, you're able to reduce redundant infrastructure — that's a huge issue — and you're able to integrate alternative energy projects, because when you have the landmass opened up, you can start to move renewables to the place where they're needed, where the greatest demand is. The third finding is that we must reduce our dependence upon diesel fuel. The fourth finding is that a single statewide entity of one kind or another, whether that's an ADA or an AEA or a new organization, doesn't matter, but a single entity could very easily, could handle the generation transmission issues for the entire state. And the fifth finding is we must ensure that we're getting the best bang for our buck. When we invest large amounts of infrastructure dollars, we need to ensure that we really are getting the very best value out of that investment. And we need, desperately, a one-stop shop for permitting and regulatory processes. And ultimately, we would like to eliminate the need for prior cost equalization. It has been a bandage for a long time, since 1984, and we would really like to be able to say, we don't need PCE anymore. We are all self-sufficient, so that's the goal. I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation of how much we're spending in this state on retail energy, and this is basically just residential and commercial electricity and heat. And conservatively, you can peg the number at $3 billion a year that's being spent on energy. If you take this, the 20-year value of that, that's $60 billion. I say that we have the wherewithal right there to pay for some very significant improvements in the cost of energy. So what is our problem? Our rural communities use diesel for almost all their energy needs. Fairbanks uses diesel for half of their electrical generation and a big chunk of their heating. They're also using wood and coal for heat. They have a tremendous air quality problem. We have a health issue associated with emissions, not just in Fairbanks, but in surrounding areas in the interior. South Central is running out of gas, and we've all heard about the crisis that's imminent in South Central Alaska as Cook Inlet's fields are delivering less and less gas to the utilities there. They're actually looking at importing LNG or CNG in the next couple of years. And our industry is languishing. We have any number of would-be mine development, resource extraction and processing, fish processing, all of that is languishing because we are not competitive in our cost of energy. So those businesses are all exported to elsewhere, not just in the country, but around the world. So Alaska does not have a competitive edge when it comes to industry, and it's because our energy is expensive. So our energy in this state is actually scarce, and it's expensive, and it's going to get more so. So we ask the question, really? We have a shortage of affordable energy in Alaska, and then we would like to draw to your attention that we have 235 TCF of stranded natural gas on the North Slope. The Henry Hub price of natural gas right now is hovering between $3.10 per MCF and $3.50 an MCF. 10 years ago, it was closer to 12, and the prospects for exploiting our gas were a lot more exciting. But as it stands today, as fracking reveals more and more natural gas around the world, we may not have a competitive edge with our gas. So let's put that gas to use for Alaskans. And I will show you shortly that it's not a very large amount of the gas that we propose to use, but it could benefit every sector in Alaska. So our solution is very large-scale generation on the North Slope, and high-voltage direct current, or HVDC lines, basically creating a very large backbone transmission grid around the state of Alaska. With this concept, we would be able to generate and distribute abundant amounts of power that could not only power the producers of the North Slope, who, by the way, are in need of new infrastructure for their generation of energy. And in addition to them, we could power the rail belt, we could power the interior, we could power remote mines and processors, and we could heat and electrify rural communities. So a little bit about HVDC. HVDC is a technology that's not used in Alaska today, but it is used everywhere else in the world, including the lower 48. It's been in use since the 1950s. The technology has advanced greatly in the last 20 years to the point today where it is used very, very significantly to transport very large amounts of power long distances and short distances, because the conversion technology has gotten down to the stage where it is now cost effective to move it across not as long distances as before. What I will show you is examples of the difference between AC transmission and DC transmission, just in the context of what you can achieve. I draw your attention to the graphic on the bottom. This is showing you when China was developing the Three Gorges project, the dam project. That is a 24.5 gigawatt project. It's mind-boggling for us. You know, we think a 600 megawatt project is a big project. So So a 24.5 gigawatt project is many, many times the size of that. They were looking at whether they would use HVDC or AC to transmit the power, and you'll see that it would take five transmission towers with three wires each to transmit 6 gigawatts of power. It would take two towers with a total of four wires to transmit a similar amount of energy on HVDC. So you have a very much smaller right away. And the other advantage with HVDC is that when you look at the graphic that shows the two wires and a transmission tower, each of those is operating independently. So if one goes down, the other one is still available. Whereas on AC, if one of those three wires goes down, the whole pole is down. So you don't have that avenue at all. So it's more robust in that context. It uses a much smaller right-of-way, so permitting processes are easier. If you look at the middle graphic there, you will see that two side-by-side power lines. On the left, you have an AC power line, which is the same about the same voltage as the DC line, which is on the right. And with the same right-of-way, you can transmit 3 gigawatts of power on HVDC as opposed to 400 megawatts in AC. So big difference in the capacity. Just a quick example of half a dozen lines that have been in service since some time ago, as well as the recent past. I draw your attention to the Pacific Intertie, which is the fourth one from the left. That is a project that has been in operation since 1985. It's a 3 gigawatt HVDC line that connects the Bonneville power system with California, and they move about 3 gigawatts of power south from Bonneville to LA for air conditioning loads in the summer, and that flow is reversed in the winter when you have a heating demand in the Pacific Northwest, and they move power up from California into Washington State. So it has been in use in the United States. Obviously, this line has been upgraded since it was first installed, but you can see if you look to the right-hand side of this little graphic, you will see that as recently as 2010, a 1,300-mile HVDC project was installed in China that's moving 6.4 gigawatts of power 1,300 miles. So it's a robust technology today that is the technology of choice to move power.
Mira, I have a question. Is there much, power lost in the transmission side going that distance?
That actually is the big advantage with HVDC, is that the power losses are negligible. They're equivalent to the losses on a gas pipeline. So it takes about 4% of the gas that's being transmitted on a pipeline to keep that pipeline flowing, and you have about similar losses with AC. So I mean with DC. So it is significantly less line losses, and the distance really it doesn't matter. Okay. So that has not been an issue. The other plus technically with DC lines is that you don't have a lot of the ailments that go along with AC transmission when you're doing long distances, so you don't have the reactive power issues that cause the line losses to dramatically increase as you get over distances.
And then one more question. What's the capability of adding renewables onto a DC line?
Any transmission grid allows the admission of renewables because what it is an avenue to get distant renewables to the source of the load. And so there's really not much difference between AC or DC in terms of making accessibility to renewables. But nonetheless, what we're looking at in our model is that we would, with a grid, you would open yourself up to the injection of renewable energy, tidal power, wind power from the north and from the west, potentially geothermal. All of those options become available when you have a transmission grid. So it doesn't matter whether it's AC or DC. You need a grid in order to be able to transmit power. That is the single stumbling block with the development of very large-scale renewables in the lower 48, for example.
Right.
And just recently, a company has been formed and has begun the process of building an HVDC line. I believe it's a 4-gigawatt line that's going to be bringing wind from the Midwest to the load centers. So, you know, it is something that has been used elsewhere as well.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that renewables can be put into the grid easily and transmitted all over the state. How competitive would renewables be with the generation if, say, you had something on the North Slope using gas? Would there be a need for renewables? Are renewables competitive with the natural gas?
Representative Foster, through the chair, there will always be a need for renewables because there's the perception that it is an emissions-free source of generation. And as you get into larger scale renewable generation, the larger the scale it is, the more cost-effective it is. And so I hear about costs of renewable generation in the lower 48, for example, that rival the cost of coal. So we're looking at 3 to 4 cent power from very large scale installations. So I actually think it would be competitive if we were able to develop it on a grand enough scale.
Representative Nagyak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, on the example you used, Intertidal Washington, California, I know. Do they follow the highways to the along the highways, or do they go to remote areas of the route to between California?
You know, Representative Nagyak, through the chair, I'm not really sure about the routing, but of course, you know, the Lower 48 is peppered with highways and roads and so forth. They don't have access issues pretty much anywhere. There are, I see lines that are going through remote areas. When you're flying, you will see rights of way that are cut through very remote areas, and so you know that there are transmission lines that I don't know what kind they are, whether they're AC or DC and who they're serving. But remote construction is very, very common. It's happening in Canada today. They're building, they have built actually HVDC large-scale transmission from Manitoba down through into the Lower 48. So, Rob, could you help me out with this? Would you mind if I bring Rob in just real briefly to talk about the Canada intertie? Rob, are you able to jump in?
I'm here. You hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Can you just put your name on the record and your affiliation?
Yeah. Hi. The Canadians have put in place multiple lines, and there's two up and running right now in Manitoba and a third in the late planning, early construction phases. And they take power there of the order of 500-600 miles. And they cross tundra and other geographies, very similar to what Alaska has, similar temperatures, similar snowfalls, similar winter conditions. And these systems have been very successful and operated with great reliability. They have the same problem you are actually alluding to, and that's lack of access. And building it is one type of access. Maintaining it is another. And what they have done is maintain it with helicopters. And a couple of years back, there was a severe ice storm with wind, which caused a couple of towers to collapse in one location. And they had the whole line up and running again in just a few days, helicoptering in new towers and restringing the lines completely in this remote area by helicopters in and out. So if you design the system from the outset to be maintained in this type of fashion, then indeed the fact that it's remote is not a truly significant feature. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. And that was Robert Jacobson from All Alaska Energy Solutions, for the record. Representative Higgins?
Hi. Thanks for being with us this morning. First, I applaud you for even looking at a HVDC line. I've done some research on that and have tried to figure out why we haven't done that years ago. I've heard that we've got a 3 to 5% line loss up per 1,000 miles, which is excellent line loss. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But that's something we should look at. I do appreciate your number four and number five statewide entities for transmissions. I think it's a great idea. And one-stop shopping for your permitting. Those are all ideas that I think we all are on board with. Mm-hmm. My question is on your large-scale gas line. for production. We've also, that's been in discussions too. What is your time frame? I mean, how much gas do you think and how long do you think a plant like that could run? 100 years, 50 years? What, have you guys looked at that number?
And we have. The large-scale gas-fired generation has... I'm sure you recall the deregulation days from 10, 12 years ago in California and so forth. And there's a big move to get away from coal-fired generation. So very large-scale gas-fired generation is becoming quite ubiquitous in the lower 48. And a typical generator actually has a life of somewhere around 15 to 20 years. But then you do the overhauls at periodic intervals, and each one of those actually extends the life of that generation. So when you look at gas plants that currently exist, there are many of them that are several decades old. It's the refurbishing of the generators that makes them.
Well, that's not, well, okay, maybe that wasn't the question. I was asking, have you looked at how much gas do we have and how long would it last?
I do have a slide that would blow your socks off.
Okay, well, that's okay. That's what I always wanted to know.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll hold my question for later in the presentation.
Representative Hughes.
I was just wondering why, since the technology was developed back in the 50s, why we didn't choose to go that route from the start. So that's one question. And then the other question, which I hope whether you'll answer it now or sometime at the end, is looking at the various findings, if you could pick one that this committee should work on first, what you would recommend.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hughes, to the chair. I already lost the first question.
Why we didn't go with
this? Why we didn't go with this technology? When this technology first started being used very substantially in the 50s, it was much more expensive than AC technology because the cost of converting the power between AC and DC was much more expensive and more complex. The lines themselves, the transmission lines, have always been significantly cheaper to build than AC. It's the transmission technology, the conversion technology, that's been expensive. So the evolution in the last couple of decades, which basically has gone to the microprocessor type substation conversion technology, that, as you know, 6 years ago when I bought a 720p flat screen TV, I paid $2,400 for it, and I replaced it with a 1080p that was 5 inches larger for $700 last year. So that's what's happened to the technology. It's been advancing in leaps and bounds in the last 10 years, and so that microprocessor technology translates directly into the converter stations, and so it is now more economically viable. It didn't used to be economically viable before unless you were moving very large amounts of power long distances. And our distances here aren't that long, relatively speaking.
And so now, is the cost comparable to DC to AC, or is it still a bit more? But
The cost for the substation is still higher than an AC substation, but it's starting to balance out against the AC. The key issue with the DC is its capability to move very large amounts of power long distances with very minimal line losses. And so that makes it very cost competitive compared with AC transmission.
And did you want your second question?
The second question, whether you want to answer it now or
as to which of those six recommendations needs to be focused on. Yes, I will get to that at the very end as to what my ask is.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, now, on the idea that HVDC is able to transmit and is effective transmitting very large loads, part of our problem is we don't have necessarily the consumption at this moment. Now, of course, we know that we could build it up, and your presentation encourages just that. But how efficient is an underutilized HVDC line?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, totally pertinent questions because those are the ones that are posed to us when we come to the state and talk with them. They go, but where's the load? And so it's one of those chicken and the egg situations where the load doesn't exist because we don't have affordable energy to supply to them. What's really depressing to me is that you have a project like Donlin Creek, which is, you know, a wonderful mine that's not, you know, controversial as certain other projects might be in the state. And they are actually in the process of permitting a gas pipeline to Cook Inlet so that they can import LNG from British Columbia for a what's going to be a 360-megawatt project in about 10 years. That is just appalling. And there are many such potential loads that exist. Until you have the availability of affordable energy, those loads are not going to develop. And so they're going to be on the drawing board as long as there is not affordable energy. We have the situation up in the Nana region. We have the Ambler Mining District. We have the Red Dog Mine. We have the Livengood Mines. We have, you know, Fort Knox that's talking about curtailing us or ceasing its operations because the cost of energy is breaking its back. This is across the state that we have these issues. We do know that value-added work. You'll recall the ADA seafood plant that was built at Raspberry International in Anchorage with the concept that we were going to be able to do local value-added processing, which we certainly could do, but we can't compete with the rest of the world on the cost of energy. And so as a result, our good jobs get exploited. Underlying all of this is affordable, available energy, and that's what we are trying to address here.
Follow up? Yes, thanks. So on that, though, oftentimes the state is reluctant, and for good reason. We get criticized if we build something that is much too expensive because we don't have the capacity. In your role with AFEC, as you see it, and you talked about an energy authority or something, maybe one of the agencies that we currently have and previous legislation gave to the governor, but getting round about, again, that cost, mm-hmm. Can we really justify spending the additional money for these large loads without really going to the industries and saying, hey, let's get some partnerships here, put some skin in the game, we're going to build this large line, but we've got to have, in our business model, your signed intent to actually use this. How do you see that playing out?
It's very valid that you have to build for the future, not for today. And you see that happening really all the time when you have the telephone industry, for example. Remember the days when we used to put in 1,200 pairs in the ground, even though the demand was only for 100 pairs, and you build for the future, and then you fight with the regulatory commission about what portion of that you're going to be able to expense today as opposed to for future generations. The big advantage I think that HVDC brings to the picture is that the cost of building the line itself does not change dramatically between the capacity of the line. So you build for the future. So what we look at in our project is building basically for a 2+ gigawatt line. So you're able to carry the load when necessary. The generation plant is always incrementally modular. You can always build it to the size that you need at a time. So you only expense that portion of the generation capacity that you need for the near future. I'll show you some numbers here if you'll give me that opportunity, and you'll see where it does not make a gargantuan difference when you build for the future. Now, what we do have when the state, for example, is doing an economic analysis, what they're looking at as well, they're looking at existing load. And what I tell you about existing load is that we sell in this state 6.5 billion kilowatt hours a year. That's the latest statistics. The city of Sacramento, California, sells more than twice as much as that in just a little tiny service area. We can do better. That's essentially what our bottom line is, that we're not talking about meeting today's existing electrical load because we believe that's there's a phantom load there that actually does not reflect what the demand truly is. So it is a bit of a case of build it and they will come. I will tell you that we're not expecting or asking for the state to make a huge investment in this, because this is so attractive to industry that it would be built more as the way electric utilities build service lines, where the party to be served essentially pays for a portion of that cost up front because they get the immediate benefit of the lower cost of energy delivered to them. So some element of that would be included in the build-out of this system.
All right. Yes, last follow-up. So let's say right now you build it up to 2 gigawatt, but you're only sending, say, 700 mm-hmm. or 600. Do you get more line loss? Do you get, you know, do the molecules separate further and become less effective?
This sounds like a Rob question to me. Rob?
The line losses decrease. They go down as the current squared. So operating at 7/3, line losses would drop to about 10% of what they would be at rated. So it's essentially free power conduction.
But Rob, if you have capacity of 2 gigawatt, but you're only using a quarter of that or whatever, is that can that still be effectively used?
Yes, it can.
Okay.
You just basically have the larger price up front of building a bigger than needed system.
Right, and that...
Yes, your power is absolutely used efficiently and effectively.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nagyak?
Well, in today's dollars, how much would this cost?
I have more slides.
Okay.
Just tell me when I can advance.
And Mary, just as a note, this is in no means makes our gas line something that we still don't need to look at. It's not a competition. I just want to make that clear to folks that we're talking about electrification and an electric grid, and it is a sad state. And I don't know if people really realize how far along Donlin is on doing that gas line. I mean, they are committed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have people like that doing that, and we've kind of been inactive on looking for solutions, things like that make me a little frustrated mm-hmm. with our movement forward on something to this caliber. So.
Okay, if I can, I'll keep going.
Yes.
All right, so this is just a graphic, an example of an HVDC-like project, which is the technology that we've been using in the last 20 years, where you have Norway that's feeding an offshore oil platform using submersible cable and HVDC. So here you have a 180-mile cable, and it's moving 178 megawatts of power, and has done so seamlessly for the last few years. The next solution shows you a project where there's an undersea cable between Estonia and Finland. Estonia is a former USSR protectorate, so it's got a very poor quality grid, and so they're buying power from Finland, which is coming via undersea HVDC cables, and there's lots of technical reasons why it performs very well. I don't want to get into that. We've got a limited amount of time, but nonetheless, it just shows you that it's used for submersible cable connections across the world, the civilized world. So again, HVDC for Alaska, we would contemplate very large-scale generators in the 300 to 450 megawatt size per generator. When you get into that size generator, you get to much higher efficiencies. You've seen that Chugach and MLMP are putting in their plant in South Central, greatly improved efficiencies over what they have at Beluga right now, but they're still only at about 41-42% efficiency. We're talking about 50% better than that with the large-scale generators. So what we're doing is aggregating those loads, and as a result, you can put in much more efficient generation. And the cost per kilowatt to install goes down as the size of the generation goes up. So that's a natural consequence of just scaling up. The first projection we look at is just a simple line between the North Slope and Anchorage to feed the Rail Belt utilities potentially. or to form at least an option for them. And here we look at, again, a 2-gigawatt transmission line and about a 1 gigawatt power generation station on the North Slope. And here are the costs associated with that. You see that the power plant is about $1.25 billion. The power line is a little less than $2 billion, and the converter stations are $600 million. We assume that this is going to be operating at 85% of capacity, and we assume 30-year capital at 7%, which is, you know, a very large number. And at that cost, you wind up with a delivered cost of power, wholesale delivered cost of power, a little over 9 cents a kilowatt hour. More than half of that cost is the capital cost of the line. So as you can see, you know, if your efficiencies improve, or you're able to get lower cost capital, or some element of state investment in that, that cost would go down dramatically very quickly. We look at using electricity for heat. We're looking specifically, for example, at the Fairbanks interior region, and we do a quick comparison and say that if your diesel fuel is delivered at $5 a gallon, which is about what it's running right now, you're paying the equivalent of a little over 16 cents a kilowatt hour for your heat if you have an 85% efficient furnace. That's if you've modernized and gotten a high efficiency furnace. You could put in a 2.5 gigawatt plant at the North Slope, and with that type of utilization, where you're selling more than four times as much electricity as we did in the entire state in 2010, you can deliver that energy for 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Then here, this is just the heat and power Fairbanks model, where we show how you get to the 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour with a $4 billion investment. Then we look at extending this line across the state to rural Alaska, basically to the Nana region and to the Norton Sound region. And we look at delivering that. We add a 600-mile tap from Fairbanks to the west. And the cost for just the tap portion is about an additional $1 billion. And this is a very low utilization tap. We're only talking about 200 megawatts on this tap. And when we just add 200 megawatts, we are able to deliver that power for an additional cost that then would total about 13 cents a kilowatt hour. As you increase the load on that line, that cost goes down dramatically because there's no additional cost for the capital infrastructure. We are asked about reliability of HVDC, and so Rob has put together this little graphic that shows you that the availability for HVDC is as good or better than AC. We get asked the question of all your eggs are in one basket. Well, that's not what we would propose. We would suggest that wherever there is a source of inexpensive gas, that we would pop a generation station in there, and you would wind up with essentially, you know, three or four or five major generation stations around the state supplementing each other across this grid. We like to point out that we make a significant difference to our greenhouse gas emissions in this state. Where we're displacing diesel generation with natural gas fired generation, you're reducing your emissions by 60%. We're looking at replacing generation facilities for the North Slope for the producers. That's a very, very large load. We're talking about somewhere in the region of 1.5 gigawatts of load up there. We're going to reduce their emissions by 50%. And by bringing in remote renewable resources into the grid, you again displace fossil fuels and so you further displace emissions. Obviously, we can't cure the problems of the world, but we can start to make a significant movement in the right direction. The question about do we compete with a gas pipeline, I think this is the critical one that you had asked. And what I show you here, if you look at the lower line, the 2.5 gigawatt project would use 113 BCF of natural gas a year. And in a 30-year life cycle, that would be 3.4 TCF, which is 1.5% of the reserves of the North Slope. This allows the development of a large-scale gas export, if that is feasible and if that is going to be pursued. Obviously, that option still exists. So we're not competing with that. All we're doing is tapping up a little bit of that gas to provide power for Alaska. So here's our summary. We can use HVDC to interconnect our state, to deliver very low-cost power to our industry, to our military, to our processors, to our residents, to our community buildings, we could do away with PCE, we could reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We can ship made in Alaska, not pieces of Alaska. That's all we do today.
Thank you, Mayor. Are there questions from the members? Representative Hughes and then Representative Foster.
Just back to my...
Back to your question of my six recommendations. You know, that's a really good question, and I haven't really... Let me take a look at them again. You know, House Energy, the Special Committee on House Energy, 2 years ago did yeoman's job in starting to try and crystallize an energy vision for Alaska. That really is, I think, what needs to be focused on is not just that vision. How do we actualize it, and how do we do it in such a way that we can achieve it in the foreseeable future? This project could technically be built within 5 years. The generation is a very simple, out-of-the-box technology. Transmission line we build in the state today. We have that technique, the expertise here locally. The converter stations are the ones that are the technical aspect of the project that would have to be done by the major internationals like ABB or whoever the organizations. ABB, by the way, has worked with us on this for a long time, and they are the developer and installer of two-thirds of the world's HVDC. So we've got very, very high-caliber technical expertise to help to develop this. We need to focus on the master solution for Alaska. We need to be visionary. We need to look out at what is it that we're not doing in this state that we could be doing, and create a means to get there. And this is it.
In order to lay out that plan and vision and that solution, do you think number four is necessary, where you would need a single statewide entity to help develop that solution?
In the lower 48, the concept of a G&T organization is very, very common. G&T is a generation and transmission cooperative. I come from the cooperative world, so yeah, that's what I'm familiar with. In the lower 48, utilities typically do not generate their own power. They purchase power across the grid. And a large group of distribution co-ops, which is the utilities, typically get together and they invest in a generation and transmission organization. And they all become owners and members of that generation and transmission organization. And then that organization develops large-scale generation and transmission to best serve the interests of all of the members. So they're not developing their own local grids in isolation of the entire group. So that sort of is the concept that I would look at, that I would think would be a good one. As we move forward with our project on the outside, that's what we're looking at, is developing an organization that would manage this asset for the entire state. So it could be, in Canada they have Crown Corporations, so you have BC Hydro and others of that ilk that do the same thing. So it can be that an AIDA could do it, potentially.
Thank you. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the biggest challenges, you know, obviously one is the cost, and we have control over that. Another one that comes to mind, and maybe there are more that maybe if you could offer those if you have any, but the other one that maybe we don't have as much control over is the crossing of federal lands with these lines. Can you address that?
Representative Foster, through the chair, those are the issues that we really want to partner with the state on. We like to be able to say that we are offering such a great alternative to current conditions that the Fed should be falling all over themselves to support it. But obviously things don't work that way. So I think it will have to be a collaboration on picking the routes, obviously, as to how you're going to cross federal or protected lands. I would imagine the state would be less of a hurdle, especially if they're a partner in the process. One of the big advantages that HVDC brings is that it can be buried for long distances. So I know that when I was looking at building a line in Katmai National Park when I was running MacNic Electric, that was a collaboration that we had with the Park Service, and we put a portion of that line underground, and that appeared to address many of their issues. So, you know, that is obviously an opportunity that could be realized. It is more expensive to bury cable, but not it's not a deal killer by any stretch of the imagination.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also just wanted to make a comment, and that is, you know, as a rural legislator, would love to not be reliant on PCE for a number of reasons. And I think, you know, looking at it, you just mentioning the state being a partner, I think that's a great way to put it, because on the one hand, you know, the cost you're saying may not be as much as we think if this is such a attractive investment that private industry is willing to put capital into this. And I think it's a great thing for the state, because that means that the state's not responsible for paying out into the PCE. And I say I like the project, or I like the idea of not being reliant on PCE, because, you know, as you know, just a few years ago we had to reduce the benefits that were paid out under PCE because the state came on hard times. And who's to say that that doesn't happen again? You know, you just never know if the price of oil goes down for some weird and crazy unforeseen reason. You don't know if the state's going to come on hard economic times, and we have to start finding cuts. And this is one place that could potentially be, you know, susceptible to cuts. And so, you know, I think looking to projects like this, I think, is a great thing, not just for rural Alaska, but for the state overall. And so I appreciate you bringing this.
Representative Foster, through the chair, you're speaking to the choir here. I have been engaged with the Paracost Equalization Program since before it existed, when it was the Power Production Cost Assistance Program, then the Paracost Assistance Program, and then PCE. And yes, I have lived through those painful days when we were taking very significant cuts. I mean, the funding was $17 million for a year for several years. The true cost was closer to $23 million a year, and we were getting paid at 60 to 65% of what PCE would otherwise have been. And absolutely, it used to be an annual battle to get full funding for PCE, and we rarely succeeded at that. So those memories are very, very close to my heart, because we've lived through those. And you try and explain to that 80-year-old couple in Mulato that their electric bill just went up 30% because PCE went down by 30%, because that's how it translates when it's making that much of an impact. But the other thing with PCE is that it only reduces the cost of 30% of the power that is sold in PCE communities. So 70% is being paid full fare. A statistic that I'll throw out here that you might find interesting is that AHFC recently completed a study on what the state is spending on energy for its state-owned buildings, $640 million a year. If we could reduce that cost by $200 or $300 million a year, that goes a substantially long way towards offsetting the cost of participating in something like this. There are enormous benefits to be gained if we really look at what the impacts would be.
Representative Negyak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, you have, on page 19, you have the bullet point on harness distant renewables, for example, North Slope, West Wind, Carol, Susitna. I thought with this project would we eliminate the, some of those projects because of, you know, you have more power than you need. Can you explain that bullet point?
Representing that to the chair, we assume that Susitna is going to happen. It has long been on the books. What it would represent here is a generating source that is obviously removed from or distant from the North Slope project. So it adds stability to the system in that you have a generation source elsewhere if it's going to be built anyway. One of the things that you will be contending with is that there does need to be substantial transmission upgrades in order to be able to move Susitna's power to the market. And we pose it that our project provides an avenue that could be used for that. So, and it's not just CISTIC-Net, as I say, you could potentially develop very large-scale tidal generation or perhaps even solar power or wind power. Once you're looking into something that's in the 400 megawatt size, you start to have very competitive costs. And so this provides an avenue to bring that to the market where that market is. We believe the market will be spread across the state because we are an incredibly resource-rich state. And so as those resources are identified, because you have affordable energy, that will allow those to be developed. And so I think CISTIC-Net is one of those cogs in the wheel. I think it is an important element. And it's renewable as opposed to smaller scale gas generation.
Hello? Yes. Have any private industry folks approached you and expressed interest that they would be willing to partner and put skin in the game if the project were to move forward?
Representatives for the chair, obviously I can't name them, but yes.
Question?
Well, first, I always liked the idea of energy. So I always like looking at everything. I was building houses in the 70s in Fairbanks when electricity was really cheap. And we were building all electric houses. Mm-hmm. And then about 6 years or 7 years down the road, all those people had to convert over because the price changed. Mm-hmm. So I'm always a little leery about when we talk about gas for our main source of energy because we just never know where the price is going to go. And so my concern would be, I'm a hydro guy because basically, the water's there. Once you build it, it's done, And so with gas, which I think is a good idea, and it's a good way of generating electricity, I would like to see some way that the state guarantees us that it's not going to go up because industry wants it to go up. And that's, I guess, would be my concern with it. But that's just my comment.
Thank you, Representative Higgins, for the chair. That absolutely. What we would propose is that when we begin to build a project, we will already have locked down the gas source and have a long-term contract that's attractive. Henry Hub shows you what has happened to gas prices, and gas is a commodity, and so it's subject to the laws of supply and demand. And when supply is plentiful, that drives the cost down. And fracking has made shale gas, so plentiful and so available around the world that I do believe that these low prices are here for a long, long time.
Thank you. Any other comments from the committee? Well, Mayor, this is near and dear to my heart, and my whole goal as a legislator is to unify our transmission and hopefully at some point in time in my life, the generation side. That's one of the things we've talked about for you and I and Marilyn for many, many years. So this is exciting for me. I'm thank you so much for coming to the committee and sharing this with us, and I hope it gets others around the state excited about the possibilities that we have and looking at transmission in a different avenue. So I applaud you for your efforts and the community outreach that you've done on educating many, many groups on this possibility. And so thank you so much. Any other committee comments? No? Thank you, Mira. And if you guys haven't had a chance to have Mira in your office, you should.
I'm always willing to come and play. So thank you so much for allowing me to present. This is something that I wanted to do for quite some time. And so anytime you wanted to redo it, more than happy to do
you
so.
You might need some refresher courses, I'm sure.
That's right.
Thank you. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease to get our next program up. With our next two presentations, I invited Representative Wilson to give some opening comments about this issue. She's been at the forefront of talking about all sorts of energy-related issues to Fairbanks, and also I want to recognize that the Majority Leader, Lance Pruitt, is here watching over me today, which I'm so happy about. Thank you for being here, Lance. Go ahead, Tammy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 2, and I really appreciate the committee taking out time for this important issue to the interior. As most of you have heard me speak about PM 2.5, which is a very small particulate that wood smoke plus other things produce, And right now we are what's called a non-attainment area for PM 2.5. And with that goes extra paperwork if we want to do any kind of projects. It could possibly affect more military coming in. And so the question is, what do we do about it? Because we're under this from the EPA. The EPA makes mandates, but they don't tell you how you, what you need to do as a community to be able to be in an attainment area. So what we have done is that we have had wood stove change-out programs. We have brought in pollution control devices, a lot of sources, and that's what the presentation is today, is to just kind of go over generally where we're at, what we're trying to do to try to reach that goal. The sad part of it for us right now is without gas, we honestly believe we cannot get there. We will continue to put in wood and coal units because that is what we can afford to utilize to be able to remain in our community, as most of us in our bush community feels the pain more than we do as far as how much the oil price is going up. So the cleaner units are coming out, but we do live in a valley, so we do contain most of our particulates. So with that, I'm going to bring in Dr. Houck, who's going to go over the presentation with you. And again, I appreciate this time.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Wilson. And, Ward, do you want to go first? Okay. Come on up and put your name on the record and who you're associated with and give us your presentation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. My name is Ward Sattler. I'm the president of Alaska Resource Agency, and I really appreciate the invitation to tell you what we are doing, what we would like to do. They say that youthful romantics becomes seasoned cynics with age. I was certainly a youthful romantic when I carried a newly minted college degree down the Yukon River in a canoe to Fort Yukon to teach. A few years later, I came to Juneau to take a position as a legislative aide to the newly formed Senate House Joint Committee on Permanent Fund. That was following the establishment of the Permanent Fund by the voters. I really enjoyed my time in Juneau as a legislative aide. It's very nice to come back a few days ago, and the sun was so beautiful. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous day in Juneau. I've gone many miles since then, but my appreciation of the comments section in the Fairbanks News Miner attests to my conversion, my metamorphosis, to a seasoned cynic. A few days ago, there were comments in response to a quote attributed to a Fairbanks North Star Borough official. The quotes were repeated in the Los Angeles Times and the Detroit Free Press, and the comments really struck my sardonic sense of humor. The comment line went, "Rubber tires burn really well, but boy, they're hard to get into my stove." Well, the rejoinder to that was, "You need a bigger stove, but the real problem is those bolted bands in the tires and getting them out of the ashes." And the next comment was, "Oh, that's what those bands are? I thought they were snares from the animal carcasses." Mm-hmm. That was in response to comments from a Fairbanks North Star Borough official, as reported in the Los Angeles Times and the Detroit Press. Well, I could laugh about that because I am a seasoned cynic at this point, but I still hold out hope. All levity aside, we're here today to talk about a serious problem of air quality in Fairbanks and North Pole. Some comments in the threads say that the air quality was worse in the 60s and the 70s and I think that is true. I was working for the University Institute of Social and Economic Research in Fairbanks in the 1960s. The pollution then came from automobile exhaust, but the advent of EPA regulations, which mandated catalytic converters, tended to moderate that air quality problem. But now with the price of energy going so high and people going back to wood stoves, old wood stoves, antiques, air quality has deteriorated again to the point where it has seriously impacted quality of life in Fairbanks and North Pole. I became aware of that pollution problem in the 1960s. I did the chemistry on it, and I realized that 1 gallon of gasoline created 40 pounds of water vapor in the air, and that water vapor, as it condensed, bound up carbon particles, the 2.5 PM that we talk about, along with all of the highly injurious chemical compounds that are contained. So now we have a problem. We have that problem anytime the inversion layer sets in. Anytime the temperature goes to minus 20, suddenly the air quality deteriorates and it stays there until the inversion layer leaves. We can't help the inversion layer. We can't do anything about that. But we can do something about the antiquated stoves. Technologies have changed dramatically. Stoves today that are manufactured today do not put out the particulates that the old stoves do. And the outdoor wood-fired boilers that are manufactured today have highly advanced computerized controls that eliminate a great deal of the pollution. So several years ago, and I'm going to start the slideshow here now, our goal with the Alaska Resource Agency is to advance sustainable renewable resource solutions for interior Alaska. Several large-scale energy projects are scheduled or proposed for completion over a decade away. These projects are good, but what can the interior do in the meantime to offset the high cost of energy and improve quality of life? Our goal is to introduce innovative, cost-effective solutions for clean heat and power. Emphasize utilization of Alaska's vast renewable biomass resources. Why is this effort necessary? Cost of energy is so high. People use the most affordable fuel and appliances to heat their homes and businesses. The least expensive fuel combined with antiquated appliances leads to inefficient, high-cost heating and a serious air pollution problem. Here's a slide showing the, it's an inventory of the wood burning devices in the area compiled by Sierra Research Laboratory. There's one number on there that we tend to question, and Dr. Houck will address that later. But this gives an idea of how many wood burning devices there are in the Fairbanks North Star Borough area. If you have questions, we can go back to this later. The Detroit Free Press last week, as I mentioned, says that air quality in parts of Alaska has been worse than in Beijing. The Los Angeles Times.
Ward, can I ask you a question?
Yes. Yeah.
Real quick. Can you talk about the outdoor wood boilers? Is it the EPA that shut down two of the wood boilers last month?
I believe that's
two outside wood boilers.
Yeah, that's a legal question at this point. I do have some familiarity with it, but I don't think we should discuss it at this point.
That's fine.
wood-burning stoves give Fairbanks, Alaska area some of the worst air pollution in the country. I'm going to speed up a little bit here as our time is running short. All the major state and private ventures intended to reduce energy costs and PM2.5 emissions are years away. The best-case scenario for Susitna Dam is 2024,
yeah,
for the AEA report.
Mm-hmm.
Best case for Fairbanks gas distribution, expanded to the point that all residents switch from wood to natural gas or propane, 2021. And when gas does come into the Fairbanks area, what will it take to get people to convert, and how long will it take to convert? Depends on the price of the gas. The lower the volume, the higher the price. It's going to take years to develop that market to the point that the price comes down to where people will switch from wood and coal to gas. In most model runs, wood switching does not occur until 2021. And that's when the volume of gas sales will increase to the point that it becomes affordable.
Question?
Representative Isaacson?
So, Mr. Ward, that is presuming not the gas trucking project, but a gas line, or is that, could you explain where you get that figure, 2021?
Yes. We don't know about the trucking. I know Senator Hawker commented last week that we've been waiting 40 years for gas. And his implication was he's not going to hold his breath. But I don't know how long it'll take or how fast the trucking will develop.
So, follow up. Mm-hmm. If we're able to increase that with the trucking and build out the distribution as planned right now and with the governor's plan and as that's moving forward through the legislature, that might speed it up. And, of course, if we speed it up, that's going to help this cynical scenario, which you're positive.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Haupt can expand on that.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. What happens while the interior waits for gas? The future of Eielson and Wainwright missions is jeopardized. Federal transportation funds might be jeopardized. Business will hurt. The housing market tends to suffer. Service industries tend to suffer. In terms of public health and economics, the interior cannot afford to wait for air quality improvement from large-scale projects. Cost-effective solutions, a new infrastructure for biomass utilization. Alaska Resource Agency addresses the interim energy and air quality problem by administering field and research and develop projects. We launched the Air Quality Attainment Project. The purpose of the project is to identify pollution sources within the hot zones, near sensitive areas such as schools and densely populated neighborhoods, reach out to the homeowner with information on upgrading or replacing their current appliances, upgrade equipment where necessary, teach homeowners best burn practices, and replace uncertified damaged and old wood stoves with the latest certified equipment. Since September of 2012, we've inspected and installed many appliances. We've installed, we've inspected and repaired. We've installed pollution control devices. We've replaced five large outdoor wood boilers with unit emissions well under EPA's pending emission standards. At this point, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Haupt. Dr. Haupt is a professor of air quality at the University of Portland, has many, many, many years of experience in air quality issues and attainment.
Any questions for Ward before he gets up? Representative Negak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, you talked about the recent field accomplishments. Were those put in by individuals, paid for by individuals?
They were put in by the Air Quality Attainment Program, and that was done under a state grant.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything else?
I would take questions after okay. Dr. Haupt.
Thank you. Thank you, Ward.
Questions will be answered by his presentation.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Houck?
You want to come up and put your name on the record and your affiliation?
My name is James Houck. I'm an independent consultant in energy and environmental issues primarily associated with home heating, and I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Portland in air quality. As Ward said, I've worked in this area for quite a while, and I believe I have to make this presentation rather rapidly. So what I wanted to talk about, I guess here, next slide here.
You're good. You have about 45 minutes.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
okay.
You're fine.
Well, I misunderstood then, so then you'll get the full meal deal here.
Okay. 10 o'clock.
Okay. I wanted to talk about the benefits of change-out, changing out the old wood heaters with new appliances, and there are numerous benefits. My opinion, is the most important is health. There's absolutely no question doing the things that's proposed by ARA will improve the health of the residents of the Fairbanks area. All other things aside, when you're putting lower emitting devices that produce less air toxics in the atmosphere, it's going to improve health. There's no argument on that. The second thing is it should contribute, and it will contribute, I shouldn't say should, it will contribute to the goal of attainment, the federal air quality standards for fine particles known as PM2.5, because the estimate I've seen is about 70% of the fine particles in the Fairbanks non-attainment area is from residential wood combustion. And of course, if you put units in there that produce less emissions, well, the ambient levels of those pollutants will decrease. There's other considerations as well. Modern appliances produce less creosote, and creosote is associated with chimney fires, which is associated with loss of property and loss of lives. Newer units are safer. The older ones tend to wear down with age, and there's more chance of carbon monoxide spillage, people having negative impacts of carbon monoxide. And also, newer units are more efficient. That means that less fuel is consumed for the same amount of energy required. And less fuel means less cost, and so there's an economy of putting new appliances in. Now, the nice thing about wood heater change-out is you don't have to reinvent the wheel to come up with candidates to replace the old units with. The EPA has had both a regulatory and a voluntary program for the various types of wood heating appliances that are available. And I'll just quickly go through these. Cordwood stoves, and there's two kinds, catalytic and non-catalytic, are certified by the EPA. There are accredited labs, and they're certified by the EPA. And this the regulation on how to do this is in the Code of Federal Regulations, and it's called the New Source Performance Standard, NSPS. So you can go online, Google US EPA certified wood stoves, and there's 15 pages of manufactured models of wood stoves that have been certified by the EPA and their emission levels, and these are the good new ones.
Dr. Houck, we have a question.
Yes.
Representative Nagyak.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, on the previous slide, you have less new units of fire, higher efficiencies, less fuel consumed, lower fuel cost for home occupants. When you talk about less fuel consumed, is that firewood?
Yes, it's cordwood. Yes,
okay.
I'm talking cordwood.
Thank you.
Talked about cordwood stoves, cordwood inserts. There are essentially wood stoves that have been designed to fit into the cavities of existing fireplaces. Many homes are built with fireplaces which are very inefficient in terms of heating. And so the hearth industry has developed models that are often analogous to their wood stoves that are designed simply to fit into a fireplace cavity. And they are also certified by the EPA, and the same list contains those units which have low emissions. So for cordwood stoves and cordwood inserts, which are really stoves putting in fireplace cavities, you can go, you being the state or any regulatory body, can go to the EPA's website and get the list of those models that are acceptable in the emission levels. Now, the next category, outdoor cordwood boilers, aka hydronic heaters, there's several different names to them, the EPA decided that it would be a very long regulatory process to get it either a code of federal regulations into the Federal Register. So they developed what they call a voluntary program where manufacturers of these outdoor boilers could go through a series, again, regulatory tests and be, as a partner with EPA, list their test values. So you can obtain a list of clean outdoor corporate boilers, again, by joining, Googling U.S. EPA's BurnWise program, and they'll have the concentration, the pollutant emission levels of these qualified units. They call them qualified rather than certified because it's a voluntary program. The next on my list here of documented clean wind burning devices are pellet stoves, inserts, and furnaces. Pellet stoves are all clean burning as compared to cordwood stoves. The difference is night and day. Some of them are certified and some are not due to a loophole in the law. It's a long story. But virtually all regulatory communities, when they're looking at what kind of devices can be burned in their airshed, recognizes pellet stoves are a good thing as compared to cordwood stoves. And also some of them are certified, so those brands can be found on EPA's webpage. Fireplaces, same sort of thing as with the outdoor wood boilers, is a voluntary program. You can find a list of fireplaces that have emission levels below the standard, or I guess not standard is the right word, the acceptable threshold the EPA has listed for those units. And then there's masonry heaters. Again, not certified because there's so few of them made. They're all very clean burning. There's lots of documentation how clean burning are, but they're also very expensive. They're really for high-end homes, but there is another option.
Dr. Hawk, question on the masonry heaters. Are they the big, they're made in Sweden or Norway, or and then they loop through the, and they, is that the masonry?
Absolutely right.
I think we saw some of those in Dillingham, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So, they're really super expensive, right?
That's correct. You're looking at many thousands of dollars, $10,000, but they're also very attractive. So, usually a decorative part of an upper scale
home. Thank you.
And then finally, one of the problems the nation faces is that right now, there's the best estimate, there are 28 million fireplaces, solid fuel fireplaces in the United States. And what do you do with an existing fireplace? And there have now been two retrofit devices designed to put into existing fireplaces that are part of the EPA's qualified program. And again, you can go online and find their emission levels and their manufacturers. So the purpose of these two slides is to emphasize that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can go to these EPA sources or the general literature and regulate what type of appliances would be appropriate to install. The other thing is a wood stove, a wood heater changeout doesn't do any good if all the, in terms of air pollution, if all the units are already certified. And that's one of the issues we had with the data that worked with Sierra Research. I believe they got their fraction of certified versus uncertified not correct. What happens is when you do a phone survey and you call up an individual and ask if the wood stove is certified, in a sense, this certification is for emissions by the EPA, but virtually all modern stoves, I mean, made in the last 30, 40 years, carry some type of UL or UL type safety label on them. And most people see that and they think that's a certified stove, and that's not the case. And this bar graph that you see in front of you is national. And it starts out in 1987 to 2010. In 1990 is about when the original NSPS, program that allowed stoves, required stoves to be tested and certified, started. And the red bar on this bar chart is manufacturer's records compiled by the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association, which is the trade organization that represents the manufacturers of wood stoves. And we obtain these records from them, and this gives you allows you to see the growth of the fraction of wood heaters that are certified. And the blue bars are the estimate of the total number of wood heaters that are in place in the United States. And it's kind of a bumpy line because there's a variety of surveys we use to obtain that number. American Housing Survey, which is part of the U.S. Census Bureau, Energy Information Administration, which is part of the DOE, the Hog-Patty and Barbecue Associates had surveys, and we also obtained information from Simmons Marketing Research, which is a big marketing firm that goes out and makes phone surveys across the United States, you know, for everything from deodorant to toothpaste to wood stoves. And so from these national surveys, we came up with an estimate of the total number of wood heaters in the United States. The bottom line, looking at 2010, the very far right bar, we came up with 35% of the wood heaters out there are currently certified. And that's not too surprising. Wood heaters are big chunks of metal. They don't wear out. And so most people don't replace them unless there's something extraordinary. They essentially, the door falls off. Or the person in the household wants to have a new enameled one that looks more attractive. So there is a big envelope of opportunity here, if you will, to replace uncertified stoves with certified ones. The other issue is this program started in about 1990, and the very first certified stoves were, quite frankly, not as good. I think my next slide shows that. No, it doesn't. No. But the earliest certified stoves were, quite frankly, not as good as the current ones, and also with anything. Some had early emission control strategies, baffles and catalysts and stuff that didn't last too long. It was, you know, the prototypes, the first ones out. So beyond just changing out the uncertified units that are out there, you're also changing out some of the very earliest certified ones would have a benefit in terms of air pollution. Now, I talked about health concerns. In my opinion, I think that's the most important issue, both in terms of perception of the Fairbanks area, in terms of real health. The pollutants that come from wood combustion are all what they call products of incomplete combustion. Basically, when you don't fully burn the fuel, if you fully burn the fuel, you produce carbon dioxide and water. Well, that never happens. And so what's left are things called products of incomplete combustion. And in this slide here, I have listed some of the key ones. One is carbon monoxide, and we all know that's not wood. And in fact, even though there are standards for that, there really is no good level. It competes with hemoglobin in your blood, produces carboxyhemoglobin. So those people that are challenged with cardiovascular issues will be more sensitive to carbon monoxide at any level. So carbon monoxide isn't good. The other is that the particles we were referring to in the PM2.5, and the 2.5 means they're small particles, less than 2.5 microns in diameter. But in reality, those particles produced by combustion are less than 1 micron, and by definition, that means they're less than 2.5 microns, so they fall into this PM2.5 category. Well, 1 micron gets in the very lowest parts of your lungs and does chemical exchange with your blood. And so when it carries toxic organic compounds, there's a very serious exposure route for humans. And then finally, there's volatile organic compounds. Everyone refers to these as VOCs. And many of these are toxic, mutagenic, and carcinogenic. And formaldehyde is a good example of VOCs. And as many of you have taken biology courses in high school knows that the fetal pigs are pickled in formalin, and the formalin is a 38% solution of formaldehyde, so it's a very bad stuff. All these things are cleaned up by complete combustion, not just the fine particles, and so that's where the health advantage comes in. The other issue about residential wood combustion is exposure. The discharge points from a residential chimney is from 8 to 35 feet. From a mobile home, the chimneys can be as low as 8 feet, and a three-story home is 35 feet, and that's close to the ground. And I suppose many of you have seen the big coal-fired power plants in the Ohio River Valley, and the reason those are so tall is the plume is diluted by the time it impacts the ground at people level. Well, that's not the case in a residential wood stove. It's 20 feet, and so this plume impacts the ground, people's breathing area, while the plume is still relatively concentrated. The other thing is that when the chimney, the stack, is at the same height as surrounding buildings, trees, and so on, there's turbulence, and that causes the plume to impact on the ground. So people have a very high exposure, more so than, say, a traditional industrial setting to residential wood soak. The other thing about exposure is that the very young, very old, and infirm are most sensitive to air pollution, and that's not surprising. And they spend most of their time indoors in residential settings where the heaters are located. And you say, well, they're indoors, but what's indoors came from the outdoors. And in fact, the survey of homes across the United States, I believe the average air exchange rate was like 1.4 air exchanges per hour. So that means every 1.4 hours, the air has been completely exchanged with outdoor air in your home. So there's nowhere to hide. Now, just a little primer, some intuitive primer on the origins of air emissions. It's a mass balance thing. This is just a silly little cartoon diagram of what goes in, what goes out. Typical burning 1 kilogram of wood requires 7.3 kilograms of air. And most of that comes out as air emissions and just a little bit of ash. So virtually everything is up the chimney. Now, much of that is inert nitrogen, obviously, in the atmosphere. But still, everything goes in, goes out, and almost all of it goes out the chimney. And the characteristics of air emissions. The fuel is organic compounds. It's made up of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. On this graph, that's CHO. You react that with oxygen in the air. And if you make complete combustion, you make carbon dioxide and water. But you never make complete combustion. So what you end up making is carbon monoxide. You make these VOCs, which are volatile organic compounds. And they contain such things as benzene and formaldehyde and a whole list of other compounds. And then you make particles, and those are essentially organic compounds that are condensed to make particles. And again, they contain a whole bunch of toxic compounds. This next slide is the HAPS list. This is published by the Title III of the Clean Air Act Amendments of 1990. They identified, I believe, 187, they've changed it a couple times, I believe it's 187, specific compounds which are identified as hazardous air pollutants. And I picked out of that a list of them in which I have emission factors for wood smoke. And a bunch of them, I guess, are a who's who of what comes out of wood stoves. You can see a whole list of them here, benzene, formaldehyde, creosols, toluene. They're all emitted from wood combustion. So now, the reduction. I'll show two tables here, and the first row, conventional stoves. Conventional stoves is just another name for uncertified stoves, these are the old ones. If you replace a conventional stove with a non-catalytic certified stove, these data, by the way, are on EPA documents, the reduction you expect is about 68% in particles. Now, you would expect the same type of reduction in the air toxics, the volatile organic compounds and the carbon monoxide, because what you're doing is essentially making complete combustion, burning up those organic materials and making water and carbon dioxide of them. So you'd expect a 68% reduction. I won't go through the rest of them, but those are the kinds of reductions you'll see. But the bottom table takes into account the increased efficiency. If you burn less fuel, you're also going to produce less particles. So when you add the fact that there's inherently a cleaner combustion with the fact that they're more efficient, then you look at changing out a conventional or non-certified wood stove with a non-catalyst certified stove, and the reduction is 71%. So that's a pretty substantial reduction. And it's not just the particles. It's the carbon monoxide and the formaldehyde and the benzene are in the vapor phase. And they're getting better. This table I did back in 2005. And what I did is I looked at the emission levels, particles, because that's what they published, of stoves that were made during the first 5 years of the certification process with ones that were made 2000 to 2005. At that time, it was the most current. And I have my little blue arrow here on the right shows that for non-catalytic stoves, that number has been reduced by almost 20%. So you would expect even better reductions with the newest technology appliances than ones that are just certified. there were boilers. There's less data on those, but there was a study done by New York State, I believe it was titled Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, where they looked at 12 models that were manufactured prior to 2005. And the emission factor on the right there is 71.6 grams per hour. Now, if you go to EPA's list of qualified units, I referred to that earlier, the average value is 4.7. So that is a dramatic reduction. Everyone thinks of wood boilers, outdoor wood boilers, these horrendous smokers out there. And they were, but they're not anymore. We talked a little bit. The Fairbanks is a federally non-containment for fine particles. The fine particles are also sometimes called respirable particles. By the very nature, they get into your lungs. And PM2.5, because they're less than 2.5 microns. There are two standards. One standard is an annual standard, annual average, and that's 35 micrograms per cubic meter. Excuse me, that's a 24-hour standard. That's 35 micrograms per cubic meter. And there's an annual standard, which just changed in December this last year. It used to be 15 micrograms. Now it's 12. So it's even going to be tougher to meet annual standards. And I just saw a map of the non-attainment area. And my only point on this is that there are a limited number of monitors in which the entire non-attainment is based. And it's been my experience working in numerous airsheds that an area like this is not homogeneous. And there are the areas which higher and the areas which lower. So one has to be very careful when you look at these numbers you're given. You've got to remember it's just one or two points in the airshed. It's not the whole airshed. So there may be areas in the community, outlying areas, low-density housing that aren't impacted heavily at all. Or there may be very concentrated residential areas where a lot of wood burning goes on and are impacted more.
How many monitors are there?
Well, I'm not an expert on that because I've just been called in on this, but my understanding has been one long-term one and, what, three others in the area?
The monitors?
Yeah.
No. There are
Representative Wilson, you know the number?
Through the chair, again, this is Representative Wilson, District 2. There is one on the state, our state building in downtown Fairbanks that directly goes to the EPA. That's the one that does not move. And then they have another one in Fairbanks by our borough building. They have two in North Pole, one at the North Pole Elementary School, and then one that's, we call it Hurst and Johnson's, kind of a low area valley of North Pole. And then there's a more recent one that has now been moved to Watershed School. They also have a little car that goes around and does the same type of travel around pretty much you can kind of see the roads from the bottom part is from North Pole. You change the top part on your map is Fairbanks, and it drives around several times a day, and you can get on the website and it will show you the good areas and the poor areas. But based on negative 20 after that, you can see the problem areas.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, the issue in Fairbanks, and I think this is perceived and a real issue, it's not so much the annual standard. It's the 24-hour standard. These are the episodic. This bar chart, the most current data I could obtain this time is the heating season of 2009-2010. And it shows that about 30 episodes have occurred during that heating season in which the 24-hour value exceeded the EPA standard. These are the time. This acute exposure is the times when the perception is that it's very bad air quality, causes asthma attacks, the emergency room is filled with folks. So these are really the bad episodes. It's not so much the long-term average, the annual average, but it's the short-term episodes. And of course, these happen when it gets very cold and people burn more fuel. There are more likely to be temperature inversions, which cap the pollutants.
And yes, sir. Doctor, this is corresponding, the rise lately is corresponding with the increase of fuel costs, which has dramatically changed our air quality. If our fuel costs were low and we were incentivized not to be burning wood through alternative methods, we wouldn't be looking at these exceedance, would we?
Well, it's possible, but, you know, certainly that's, I'm sure that's a factor, but I would argue that meteorology and temperature is also very important, too. Even if you had the same population of wood burners and you had a year in which was colder and they burnt more fuel, now, I think that's more of an overlying fact in the short term over these couple of years, because I would find it difficult to believe that people have changed out significantly over a couple-year time period, you know, going from, say, from wood to oil or back and forth. It's possible, certainly, but I think the biggest overlying effect here is meteorology, why you see the variability from year to year. And I suspect there's growth in your community, too, so there's probably every year more houses.
Do you have any data to back up your understanding of it versus our... We live there, and so we know exactly what it seems.
Yeah.
We see more and more wood piles, in fact, mine, and much more usage of wood because it's at a $2 gallon equivalent versus we're paying $4-plus dollars for our heating oil, and so it's just economically expedient.
Yes, I understand, and I don't have any data, and perhaps you're right. But I suspect it's probably a combination of several things.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. I just show this slide with the blue arrow here. That's the annual design value. The EPA for determination of standards averages the previous 3 years. And you can see the value there is 11.2, and the new standard is 12. So currently, or at least as of, I guess that was 2009 design value, the annual standard was met, but not by much. And so there's certainly a benefit having a change out for maintaining compliance with the annual standard. And it will also, as I'll show you an example coming up here, will also, I think, most significantly in change cause the frequency of the 24-hour standard exceedance to decrease. And basically, this slide is what I just said, is I think the 24-hour exceedance will probably decrease most significantly. It will certainly help in keeping these annual standard, in compliance with the annual standard, because it's now so close. And it might even help slightly with the carbon monoxide maintenance area in Fairbanks, downtown Fairbanks, because wood stoves do produce carbon monoxide. The key issue is vehicular, but nevertheless, it may help a bit on maintaining the carbon monoxide levels.
And just for time management purposes, we have a little under 10 minutes left.
Okay. Well, let me, really what I want to talk about quickly is the energy cost due savings, and I was just involved in a similar change-out program in Living, Montana, and very analogous to what the conditions are in Fairbanks, and it was successful, and I'm going to show you what really happened. And so, but anyhow, quickly on the energy cost, I noted earlier that the efficiency of certified stoves were greater than the uncertified ones. And so you assume there are between 5 and 10 cords burned per year. And you change out an uncertified stove with a catalyst or a non-catalyst stove. The red numbers at the bottom are the savings you would expect from burning 5 to 10 cords. The $283, the $566 that was an uncertified stove that you changed out. And $344 to $688 if it was a catalytic certified stove that was replaced. So those are substantial savings, 21% and 25%, just from the efficiency alone. Burn less fuel for the same heat. All right, this is what I think is important. Here's reality. Living, Montana. The change-out occurred 2005 to 2008. Living, Montana is a cold climate in Montana. Not as cold as Fairbanks, obviously, but it's cold. It is an isolated valley. The primary source of fine particles are residential wood combustion. And the change-out program basically changed out all the wood heaters. And so I'll show you what that did. This slide's just a summary of the different sources. The blue arrow shows that local wood smoke was 66%. Many other small contributors, and my understanding is very similar to the Fairbanks area. This slide is very important because of the timing issue that I see here. I think there's concern about the length of time it may take to make meaningful change in the natural gas. And these, basically the change-out program happened in two seasons in Libby. The yellow bars in this plot show the number of new stoves that were put in, or old stoves taken out, however you want it, in three heating seasons. And all but about 20 or 30 of them were changed out in two heating seasons. And most of them were in the 2006-2007 heating season. So this is a short-term fix. You're not having to wait 15, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever the real time is. This can be accomplished, at least it was in Libby, in 2 years. And they had about 1,100, I believe, stoves there that were changed out. As I noted, I think the biggest advantage will be the decrease in the number of 24-hour exceedances. In this table, 2004-2005 was the year before the changeout. There were six 24-hour exceedances in Libby, Montana. 2007-2008, there was only one. This is when there was the year there was only 20 stoves left to change. And then I have data, I don't have it on the graph, for the following 4 years, and it was 1, 1, 1, and 0. So you went from 6 days with your exceedances to 1, 1, 1, and 0.
If I may, do you have meteorological evidence also then? Because we're kind of getting to the same idea, but then you threw in that meteorological cold weather, and et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, maybe the next slide, I'll take it back here. Do I have it here? Oh, what happened? We seem to have run out of slides here.
You know what happened to the slide?
Okay. All right. First of all, I guess I'll have to talk from memory. That's a very good point. And when you look at the average values, they fluctuate a little bit, just like the exceedance they did in Fairbanks. But that's why we went for 4 years after the 2007-2008, and it was 1, 1, 1, and 0. And then if you look at the heating season averages, there was in August, the annual averages, they fluctuated. So we took the average. The average, well, was 5 years, because the last year we counted, they all changed out, even though it was like 20 put in. Now, 5 year time period, the reduction was about 30 on average. And sort of like climate change, we expect short term fluctuations on top of the trend. And this is exactly what you saw there. And it's interesting, when people said, oh, we had a really tough winter, guess what? The emissions were higher. And we try to normalize that using heating degree days. I'm not sure you're familiar with that term. But it correlated. Clearly, under the coldest days, you had higher values. So the last two slides here, are on economics. First of all, one thing when you do the calculation of the advantage of wood heated over, say, oil, gas, electricity, you assume people are buying the cordwood. But national surveys, and I didn't have surveys obviously of Alaska, but national surveys in 1993, done by the Department of Energy, came up with a number of 66% of the people said that they cut their own, harvested their own firewood. And then there was a Minnesota survey in 2007-2008 showed that 58% of the people did it. So if you're low income, perhaps unemployed, there's another tremendous financial advantage of having the ability to harvest your own wood beyond just the purchase value. And I'll just skip to the last one here. We did a realistic scenario about the economy. Two households. And I assumed that the heating demand ranged from 115 to 230 million BTUs. And it's a long story I come up with, but I think that's a reasonable range of what people face in Fairbanks. And I assumed that the heaters had the same efficiency, about 80% efficiency. And when you're talking about furnaces and boilers, that's probably not too bad. So on this slide, household number two had a fuel oil furnace at $4 a gallon. So the price cost of fuel ranged from $3,316 to $6,632, $3,000 to $7,000 more or less. If you use an outdoor wood boiler and the cords being $275 a cord, the value of the cost was $1,375 to $2,750. So by simple subtraction, you can see somewhere between $2,000 and $4,000 in cost savings by having an outer wood boiler as compared to a conventional fuel oil furnace. So that completes it.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members? No. Representative Wilson, would you like to make some closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Representative Wilson, District 2. And I just wanted to just bring a couple of points. First of all, I know for a lot of you that this is probably news that you haven't heard before, but I just wanted to point out why now. And the reason is that because we are underneath deadlines for the EPA. Actually, it was 2014. We're probably not going to be able to meet those guidelines. And so in our state implementation plan, which is the plan that we have to put forward for the EPA, saying, how are we going to get from point A to point B? We know that the pollution control devices that have been used on the outdoor boilers has done a lot to reduce how much goes into our air. We know changeouts have done a big portion of that. But at the end of the day, we need a different source of energy. And that's why we are pushing so hard for the gas. It is also for air quality as well as for the pricing. And it also helps not just Fairbanks, but the areas around Fairbanks as well to help with the cost. Because we are now the only community that's non-attainment. But as they keep dropping these numbers down, sadly to say, we probably won't be the only community in there. So we could be proactive and try to prevent it from happening to other communities. Because believe me, when they're starting to talk about burn bans in a community, you know, we literally have just gone against each other trying to figure out those who burn wood and those who don't. When the whole issue is, and as Representative Isaacs has said, it is about the cost of energy and what type of energy that is, because we know oil still contributes as a secondary PM2.5. We know gas is a cleaner unit to be able to go, or electricity, both of which we just know that electricity, once we're sitting, is a lot further out there. So I really do appreciate giving us this time.
Representative Foster, then Representative Hughes, then Representative Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to underscore the importance of why you need to do this, what happens if you don't meet those requirements, those federal requirements at the federal level? What are the consequences?
Through Chair, Representative Foster, right now it's our understanding that we can lose our highway transportation funding for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, which can range anywhere from $12 million to $20 million, depending upon the year. And for us, that's pretty substantial.
Representative Hughes?
And that was one of my questions. My other was, can you provide us with, or is there health data showing that that's what's happening currently with the situation for the Fairbanks area? I know we've mentioned health, but I'd be curious to, if there's actually been some report on increased asthma attacks and things like that.
Through the Chair, Representative Hughes, absolutely we can get that to you. That is one of the number one areas that we actually hit some all-time highs of over 300 parts in this one area that we're doing. You can now see some of the issues because of wood burning has become, you know, and I want to make sure, because people think people are burning poorly, and that is not the case. What the case is that more people have put in wood stoves, certified wood stoves, so when they're certified, they're done in a laboratory. They're not done at negative 20, negative 30 temperatures, and so we're seeing, and they don't use the wood that we have, but we will definitely get that into your office, and we'll get to the chairs so she can pass out.
Thank you. Representative Higgins?
Just a kind of a quick question, you know, on the change out. So everyone understands on the change out program that you had in Montana, right?
Yeah.
What was the change out? What did you change out to?
Okay. The city of Libby and Lincoln County required that there were no longer any wood burning in any device that wasn't certified or wasn't a pellet stove. So basically, a person had a cordwood stove. They could, one, remove it completely. Two, they could replace it with a certified unit, or they could put a pellet stove. And most people did like with like. There were a few unusual that totally took it out because they didn't use it, or they went to a propane furnace or something like that. But most was like to like. If you had a wood stove, you usually changed it out to a certified wood stove.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Madam Chair, I want to add one thing to that. Sure. They actually brought the stoves in and had them put in. You know, unlike our change-out program where we have to put the money up front and then get a portion of that reimbursed, Libby actually
did a public-private partnership and brought in the stoves into the community. And I think we're looking at more like 5,000 stoves versus 1,000. But I think what made theirs work a lot quicker is because they brought them all in, they made the plan right there to where people didn't have to try to figure out the funding when they're already hurting for money.
Thank you. Any other comments? No? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sadler and Dr. Houck and Representative Wilson for being here. I really appreciate it. And with that, we'll adjourn the meeting right on time at 10 o'clock a.m.